You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Babylon 5 ended a great war and united 100 alien races in peace. Danger didn't die. It just went underground with new heroes and new evils to carry the torch.
We need to make sure they all understand we will not be intimidated.
What is wrong with you people?
We have to set him against himself.
It's an entire new season of Babylon 5 with all new episodes.
And so it begins.
There is a hole in your mind.
What do you want?
No one here is exactly what he appears.
Nothing's the same anymore.
Commander Sinclair is being reassigned.
Why don't you eliminate the entire non-home
race? I want a reaching out of the stock.
Who are you?
President Clark has signed a decree today declaring
martial
law.
These orders have forced us to declare independence.
Weapons and
supplies. People get off their encounter-suited butts and do something.
You are the one who watches.
To Zahadu, who will die.
Why are you here? Do you have anything worth living for?
Think of my beautiful city.
Giants in the playground.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy!
We are here to place President Clark under arrest.
Turn around. Very, very slowly.
Hello, Mr. Garibaldi. Good to see you again. I was wondering how you were doing. Have you written, called?
Shut up.
Obviously haven't improved your manners.
Hello, and welcome to the Epsilon 3, a Babylon 5 rewatch podcast. Each week, we review an episode of the 1990s sci-fi TV classic, Babylon 5.
This week, the Babylon 5 TV movie, A Call to Arms.
I'm Paul.
I'm Dan.
I'm Sean.
And we are the Epsilon 3.
And first off, before we go any further, I need to make a correction to last week's show, where I said that Legends of the Rangers was released on the 3rd of January 1999. It was, in fact, released on the 19th of January 2002. This film we are about to review is the one that was released on 3rd of January 1999.
Uh-huh.
So, apologies for that error on my part. I totally misread the wiki page where they have it slightly, the release date is above or below where it should be, and I just misread the wrong one. So in fact, this was filmed and released before the last episode.
Gotcha. But it's still in the right JMS order.
And this is where it gets really weird, because this runs nicely into Crusade, where the previous one was the pilot for it that failed. So weird. And the synopsis. When allies of the shadows seek revenge against Earth, President Sheridan seeks aid in the unlikeliest of places in order to save his world. While a Babylon 5 film, it also sets up the spin-off series Crusade, introducing the ship that the series is set on, two major characters, and its backstory. Written by JMS and directed by Michael Vijar, this episode was released on January the 3rd, 1999, and takes place December the 17th to December the 30th, 2266. Big breath. And the guest stars. Carrie Dobro as Jurina Nafiel, Peter Woodward as Galen, Tony Todd as Leonard Anderson, Tracy Scoggins as Captain Elizabeth Lockley, Tony Maggio as Drake, Michael Harris as Bishop, Scott MacDonald as First Officer, Wayne Alexander as Drac, Carlos Bernard, Communications, Carlos Bernard, big fan, he was in 24. Bert Boulos, Navigation, Ron Campbell as Drazi, David Coburn as Mimbari Ranger, Mo Gallini as Rolf, Valeria, Giran as ISM Reporter, Margene Holden as Earth Force Navigator, Andre Hules as Yuri, Tim O'Hare as First Mage, Tom Ramirez as Second Mage, Larita Shelby as Lynn Anderson, and Kayla Spell as Sarah Anderson. So, guys, what did we think of this film?
Well, I've got to say, out of all of the Babylon 5 TV movies that we've watched, this is the best one.
Oh.
Yeah. I do recall it slightly. It's been a long, long time since I've watched it. But the Dorina Nafeel character, she seems like a fully fleshed out, well-established character that we've probably seen 100 times before, even though we're just getting to know her before. The actress who played her did a really great job. The Galen Mage guy, he just seems like he's on the verge of laughter all the time. So I'm not sure if he's a good actor or not, but I guess we'll find out in Crusade, because I know he's in the Crusade series, although I've only seen a few of the episodes. Some of the effects were a little bit dodgy, but overall, pretty good story. Where are the dreams coming from? That's not really explained, but I guess we'll just gloss over that. It's fine. It's okay.
Okay, Dan.
100%. Yeah, this is definitely the best. Of the four movies we've watched so far, this is by far a huge leap through the jump gate, better than the three we've had before. Third Space, which had nothing to do with anything. Rangers, that didn't matter. And God, I've even forgotten the other one. Oh, yeah, River of Souls. Oh, God, yes. This was actually, it felt right in its place where it is. Little bit cheapened by the fact that it really is just setting up another series. Like, it feels like it could have been something on its own. I feel like there was something that because it is a backdoor pilot, it's giving over too much to that. So it kind of took it away for me when we come to ratings and things like that. It feels too much like, oh, hey, don't worry, there's a series coming, kids. And I don't feel like it could just enjoy being a movie in its own right because of that. Yeah, I completely agree. The female warrior character and where she's going, learning more about her. I hope that we see her throughout the run of Crusade, because I really was invested. I feel like she did enough. And contrary to what happened in the Rangers, we saw her do the cool stuff. So now we know she's a cool character. It wasn't explained to us that she is, oh, she's the best pickpocket around. She's the best, by weird sunglasses guy who's running the down below now. Who he is, I don't know. Cut Price, Richard O'Brien, who's Galen. It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes the drac. He's just ready to start.
Just a
horror
jump
show
to the left.
And a jump gate to the right. Volans to the right. I'm just waiting for him to break out in song, and suddenly Tim Curry's going to be there in fishnets. It'd be great. But no, I couldn't take him seriously either. He was just, I don't know, he felt like he was in on a joke. It really did feel like Sean said that he was about to laugh in every scene, that he wasn't taking it seriously, so I wasn't taking him seriously. Hopefully he improves if he comes back for Crusade as well, which I think he does because he's in the posters. And then we get Candyman, Kern. We get the guy who is 100% absolutely going to die by the end of the movie, because he tells his kid he's going to deal with the monsters under the bed. Oh, my God, the foreshadowing in that scene. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to recovering it and then doing our ratings as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is a much better story. You got the feel of a spin-off. At the end, it was obvious it was leading into something that took a long time to get around to making. So yeah, I for that I liked it a lot. The dream sequences, a bit weird. Could have done without them. There was enough intrigue. Who were these three people that he was going to meet up with? And they all arrived at the same place, but one didn't quite make it. That was an unusual twist. I like that. Like you say, I like Jurina. I think she's a really good, well, she's a fabulous actress anyway, but you can tell that just by her presence and the her voice is perfect. She sounds as though she could kick somebody's ass before she even does. and she's a pickpocket. I mean, we'll get to the scene where she arrives on the station and She has to take her weapons off. And the second thing she takes off is a 3-foot flipping sword from the back of her neck. I mean, that's impressive. Where did you hide that? I mean, come on. So, yeah, it was pretty good. I enjoyed it a lot more than the previous film, a lot more sort of, you know, than the some of the previous other films we've watched, and quite a lot of more of the episodes we've seen. So, yeah, it was good. We get some really cool ships. The effects seem to be a little bit better this time around.
Definitely.
You know, they've definitely got their act together. They've got a bigger budget for this one, by the looks of it. And, yeah. So, I like it. So, let's get into the review.
Meanwhile, on Earth and Minbar, preparations continue for next month's celebration marking the 5th anniversary of the Interstellar Alliance. Aside from one brief conflict with the Centauri Republic early in its first year, ISA President John Sheridan has delivered on his promise to maintain peace among all its member worlds. Although ISA Vice President Delenn continues to make appearances during these preparations, Sheridan himself has not been seen for several days. Speculations on his absence range from the flu to a goodwill mission to Narn. In other news, ground was broken today in Earth Dome for a monument dedicated to the many who died in the recent telepath crisis, including...
Michael Garibaldi and President Sheridan have met on a Minbari White Star vessel to have a spot of lunch. Michael reminds us that he is the head of Edgar's Industries, while Sheridan says that he hasn't been able to be as involved in the reverse engineering of Minbari and Vorlon tech to work with human tech as he would like. The ship is about to jump. Sheridan says he's never seen anything that could keep up with a White Star at full speed. Except for the thing that's following them, that is sending back images to someone holding a glass orb the size of a baseball. The person is called Galen, and his presence is required by the Circle. He says he is busy, but the messenger says they know of his activities, and he must come to them, or they will come to him. Either way, he will be called to account. Eventually, after a few sarcastic comments and a very British accent to prove that he could be the bad guy, he reluctantly goes with the messenger. The White Star has arrived at the rendezvous point, and right in front of them, there is a new ship, which is the first of a new prototype of destroyer. On board, typically, they're not quite ready as they are welding things. Samuel Drake greets the President and Garibaldi as they board the new ship. They begin the tour. The gravity system is only working at slightly less than 1G, but Garibaldi says he prefers that as it means he weighs less. Yes. Oh, there's a lot of that in this thing. We are given a tour of the bridge, which includes the map room, conference room, navigation and helm control, comm systems and weapons. They haven't had time to test the ship, which annoys Sheridan, who says he should try to see whether the thing actually works before they start polishing the chrome. Just then, a message comes through for Sheridan from Delenn, and he leaves the bridge. Drake and Garibaldi test the propulsion system, which of course doesn't work. Sheridan plays the message from Delenn. After a lot of flashing images and mathematical equations flashing up on the screen, Sheridan is in some sort of trance. Garibaldi enters the room and has to call Sheridan twice before he responds. He asks if he is okay because he has been in his room for half an hour, and Sheridan insists he's only just got here. He says the message was scrambled and there was a lot of gibberish, to which Garibaldi says if you want to see some gibberish, he should swing by his quarters sometime and he'll show some 20th century television. Sheridan decides to take a rest, as he thinks he must be more tired than he thought. Meanwhile, on Babylon 5, Zach Allen is monitoring the disembarkation of the latest transport arrival. As a female walks through the security gate, it sets off a weapons violation alert. He calls her over to one side and asks her to remove her weapons, or she will be asked to leave the station. She removes some pointy thing off her finger and throws it on the table. Zach says, "All of your weapons must be removed." So she proceeds to fill the table with 9 knives, a garrote, and a large sword. She then asks where all of the forgotten people go, and Zach tells her down below, in Brown Sector. That was an impressive sword, I must admit. First thing, straight out the back of the neck.
That kind of scene is a bit of a trope, but it's always fun.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen it many times before in things, yeah. Meanwhile, Sheridan is having a fitful rest. He is having a dream about a planet on fire, which he is overlooking from a ledge. Galen appears, and he asks Sheridan if you can hear anything. And Sheridan says no. Galen says, yes, this is a dead planet. Sheridan asks who he is, and he says he has a friend called Galen. He says the attackers are coming back, and says in a very dramatic and pantomimey way, remember what you have seen. And promptly disappears, leaving the name Daltron 7 etched in the rock. Sheridan then wakes up and finds himself back on the ship, which is now moving. They are actually being towed. The mysterious woman who has a cutlery fetish is now in down below looking around. She moves a piece of cloth and finds a symbol printed on the wall. Of course, somebody is watching her and following her. As she walks through Brown Sector, she finds more of the same symbols, which are leading her up a ladder. She gets to the top of the ladder and is kicked in the head and knocked out. When she wakes up, she is on the same burning planet that Sheridan was just on. Suddenly, Sheridan appears. She says, no, I can't be back here. She then runs towards Sheridan, and he disappears, and is replaced by an alien, who also disappears. Then Galen appears. When she wakes up, she is on a podium chained up with lots of people watching her. An alien, who is obviously the leader, says, you were having a bad dream, and have awakened to another. He asks her, what is your name? And she replies, Jurina Nafil. She is asked by another if she has a mark, and she reveals a tattoo, which is the same as the symbol she was following on her chest. She is asked who trained her in the ways of the Thieves Guild, who was his teacher, and other questions designed to find out if she is who she says she is. To prove this, she escapes from the chains and beats up one of the goons. She is then accepted by the guild and told the rules and then released. Meanwhile, on the destroyer, they are about to test weapons. Level 1 is disappointing, so they go to level 2, but Drake is nervous, as they were based on Vorlon technology and use all of their power, so they should only be used as a last resort. But they ready the weapons anyway. As the target is locked on the main screen, Sheridan sees that it is Earth and the moon. He jumps up and tries to point this out to everyone, but when he looks back at the screen, it is just rocks that are being targeted. The order is given to fire, and all the lights go out as power is sent to the weapons. Apparently, there is hardly enough energy to power the gravity control or navigation or fire again for at least a minute. Now, I think there's a missing scene here, because if you lose gravity control when you fire it, and for 1 minute there is no gravity control, everybody should be floating around the place, bumping into each other. So where was that when we needed it?
Emergency gravity plating. It always works.
Ever the practical man, Sean.
And I got to say, when John saw Earth, his acting was a little bit dodgy there too.
You reckon?
He didn't seem convincing like he normally did during the series. It's like, oh yeah, okay, this is a nice paycheck. I'm just going to kind of phone it in. I'll do a little bit of okayness, but
he was playing unhinged a little bit too close to the bone. Sometimes it was. It wasn't the Sheridan that we've seen. I mean, you could say that, you know, 5 years of being president, maybe it's made him a bit jumpy. But yeah he was a bit more on edge in this TV movie.
Yeah, it just didn't seem right.
Sheridan says a lot can happen in a minute, but when he turns around, he's in a cave with three hooded figures around a fire. When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won, that will be ere the set of sun. Where the place? Upon the heath. There to meet with Macbeth. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong. Sorry, wrong.
You're trying to drag us into some sort of proper podcasting territory here. That's too highbrow for us.
I know, Shakespeare.
Cut it out.
I had to Google it.
Culture? We're not here for culture.
Yeah, the only culture we've got here is in this old coffee mug that I haven't washed out for a while. Outside, there are two moons in the sky, which is the best place for them, I find. Someone is not happy about Sheridan being here.
It's a mistake. Shouldn't have brought him here. Bad enough you've been sending probes outside, sending signals that can be tracked back to us, but this, you're endangering all of us.
We agreed to have no contact with the outside.
And if our silence means the death of billions? You said I should explain myself to all involved. He is involved, whether he knows it or not.
Galen, this is premature. We can't make contact without proof.
We can't get proof unless we contact someone on the outside. This is insanity.
Perhaps that's true, but these are insane times.
And this one?
See, the best you could do.
As a matter of fact, yes. He is the one person who can give us what we need. We all know what is at stake here, if I'm right. Yes, we must protect ourselves, but we cannot do so by abandoning those we left behind.
All right. We will allow this one contact, but no more.
Sheridan says to Galen that they are upset with him.
And if your actions compromise our hiding place, if we risk death because of your actions, understand that you will be the first of us to die.
But he says not upset, afraid.
They're upset with you.
Not upset, afraid. Fear makes wise men foolish. In my case, I can only hope it makes fools wise.
They came to this place during the Shadow War.
Do you know who, what we are?
So my guess is you're Technomages. I met one of your kind before. He was joining the rest of you, leaving known space.
Do you recognize this place?
Zahadum, the homeworld of the Shadows before they left for the Rim.
They left, but their allies remained.
Some of them, you know, as the Drac.
We've been watching the Drac for some time.
Sheridan needs to find out what they are planning, because if he doesn't, Earth will suffer the same fate as Deltron 7. Finally, the plot. Suddenly, Sheridan finds himself back on the ship and interrupts Drake, saying, "We have to go." When Garibaldi asks where, Sheridan replies, "Babylon 5. On the way, Garibaldi asks Sheridan why Babylon 5. Sheridan says he does not want to tell him yet, that he is not sure he believes it himself. Garibaldi suggests that they stop off at Minbar and see Delenn, as Sheridan has been under a lot of pressure lately. Sheridan says he's fine, and they are going to Babylon 5. He tells Garibaldi to find out about a planet called Deltron 7. On another ship, Captain Leonard Anderson, played by the great Tony Todd, has changed course to Babylon 5, and his first officer wants to know why. He says not to worry, as he knows what he is doing. He hopes. The White Star arrives at Babylon 5 and Sheridan is met by Captain Lockley. He asks her to see if anyone in the pictures he has drawn on the way are on board the station. If they are not, then they might be soon. Jureen in the field is picking a pocket or two, as is her wont, but spotted by a couple of security guards as she matches one of the pictures that Sheridan has drawn. She makes a run for it but is captured by 5 guards. Lockley and Sheridan are trying to work out who Jureena is. She is from Xander Prime, but that is a dead world that was wiped out during the Shadow War. They used their biggest weapon, a Death Cloud, which uses thermonuclear weapons, fired from the cloud, penetrating the planet's core and destroying it from the inside out. Just then, a message comes through from Captain Anderson. He asks if, by any chance, has Sheridan been looking for him? He is the spitting image of the second person that Sheridan has sketched. They meet up. Not many people tower over Bruce Boxleitner, but Tony Todd certainly does just that.
He's a big guy.
He is a big guy. I mean, even Bruce Boxleitner is 6'3".
Something like that.
So Tony Todd's something, it must be 6'5", 6'6". He's huge. But a fantastic actor.
Oh, yeah.
There isn't a single scene in here where you believe who he is. Mm. But you don't believe who he is. I know what I mean.
I know what you mean. at this point in the movie, though, it did make me start thinking about all the really bad D&D games I've tried to play over the years. I've never been able to play a successful game with anyone. And by the time you get everybody together, the pickpocket, the big soldier, you know, the important, like, do good paladin character, nobody wants to do anything and it's not going anywhere. It yeah. did drag this bit of the movie down for me a little bit, because they were all kind of just, oh, we had this crazy dream, and they're all kind of conspiratorial, but nothing's happening. Like, the plot yeah. needs to carry on. Come on. Yes. Somebody roll a dice, for crying out loud.
They were both drawn here, and when Jorina Nafeel is brought into the room, she attacks Sheridan, screaming that it is all his fault and that her world and family were destroyed. Sheridan convinces her that it was not him, but the Drac, and he can give her the chance to strike back at the people responsible for the death of her world, before they do it to somebody else. But there is still one more person from his drawings missing, Adrazi. However, if they're going to take on the Drac, they will need a bigger ship. They're bigger than anything that Captain Anderson has ever seen. Sheridan says he thinks he knows the very thing.
How convenient.
Yeah. Garibaldi and Lockley are waiting for a meeting with Sheridan, but he has left the station overnight. Garibaldi tries to contact Drake. Drake, however, is currently talking to Sheridan on Captain Anderson's ship, and is being told that there has been a breach in security and he is not to talk to anyone other than on this frequency they are using now. Sheridan arrives on the destroyer along with the crew of Anderson's ship and proceeds to take it over. They set course for Daltron 7. On arrival, they find a dead planet and not the paradise that the reference table describes. Instead of clear skies and warm weather, they find a high degree of carbon ash, indicative of surface eruptions, and the planetary core is well below normal. On closer inspection, there is evidence of multiple impacts. But this planet is well outside of the war zone, and the war has been over for more than 6 years, so they would have expected to have heard something about this. Then they find an energy signal, which turns out to be a Drazi distress signal. They go down to the planet to find out if there is anybody down there. When they arrive, they find the place that was in Sheridan's dreams, where the beacon is, along with a very dead Drazi. Captain Anderson has been taking some readings of the planet. He asks Sheridan if he is sure that this planet was attacked by a death cloud. Sheridan says he has never seen any other weapon that could do this sort of damage. Anderson asks if it was definitely 6 years ago that this happened. Sheridan says yes, as the shadows took all of their weapons away with them and they left. Anderson then says, we have a problem, as all this damage only happened a week ago. They searched the Drazi, but nothing of any value was found. Then Jorina cuts open the Drazi underneath the arm. Apparently Drazi males have a pouch in the armpit, inside which is found a data crystal. Anderson asks how she knew that the Drazi had a pouch in the armpit, to which Sheridan replies, it's not actually a pouch. It's more of a reproductive area. Ooh, ow.
That was not his knee.
Not everyone keeps their genitals in the same spot.
Especially Londo Malari. And they leave the planet on the shuttle with some jaunty music. I thought it was a bit odd, you know. Just, oh, that's not his armpit.
Yeah. She stabbed him in the dick.
If, in fact, it was a male Drazi. Mm. So, hence the pouch.
Anyway. The Drazi, though, was the best actor in the entire show.
Oh, dear. Jorina says that Sheridan said that they won the Shadow War, and the Shadows took their weapons with them. So how could this be evidence of Shadow weapons? Sheridan says that when the Shadows left, they left some of their weapons behind, but he didn't think that anybody else knew where they were or how to use them. Obviously, the Drac knew where they were and how to use them. Garibaldi has caught up with Drake, who is giving his account of how Sheridan stole the two prototypes. He says he was like a man possessed, barged in, taking the ships by force. Garibaldi is not impressed. He wants to know where he has gone. Then he remembers he was asked to look up Daltron 7. He sets the course of his White Star to Daltron 7 at best speed. Anderson makes a call to his wife and child, but has to go because the Drazi data crystal has been decoded.
And the dreams spoke to me. They called on me to come to this place. When I arrived, the destroyer was here. I sent a probe in to examine it. It looked like this.
Maybe you should.
No. I'm all right. Just promise someday you'll let me kill that thing.
It isn't alive.
No?
It is a terrible thing. A slayer of worlds. An echo of the darkness we thought had finally left us. When it was finished, the others who were with it took it away. I followed them to this location. I would have investigated further, but there were too many. And so I am returning to Deltron 7 to see if there are any who can be saved. Then I will wait for the others in my dream to come. With luck, the Dark Ones will not find me before they can arrive. End message.
Just then, Captain Anderson says they have company. Four Drak ships appear and take position so they can scan them. A message comes out of the Drak ships. They ask, who are they and why are they here? Sheridan says not to reply, but Jurina tells them to send a message telling them, we came here to attend to our enemies, but found that somebody had already dealt with them. We were hoping to thank them, whoever was responsible. Which I thought was a good response, and was waiting for it to happen to see what was going to happen. But nothing did.
Yeah, I don't think they actually sent the message, did they?
No.
No.
No, it was a really good idea. I think it was just padding. It's, you know, give us something to say, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
But before any message can be sent, a high-pitched frequency comes through the speakers. It is a message from the Drak to the ships. The Drak ships are holding steady. Sheridan doesn't like it, so he orders battle stations. He jams incoming transmissions, gets navigation to give full power to the engines, and the ships start to approach, so Anderson targets two of the ships. The weapons of the Drak have no effect on the hull of the prototype, and when Anderson fires back, they turn tail and run away. Sheridan is targeting the other two, but they head towards what looks like a small black hole, called a null field. He powers up the main guns ready to fire, fires, and of course loses all power. They enter the null field to find every single Drak ship hidden inside. As Anderson wonders where they have gone, Excalibur comes out of the null field and he tells Anderson that he doesn't think the Drak ships are jump capable and to get ready to run as fast as they can and make for the jump point as the Drak fleet are on their way. They get to the jump point and enter making a course for Earth. Sheridan put a call through to Captain Lockley.
Mr. President, I'm glad you finally decided to check in. We've been worried about you.
Well, you've got good reason to be worried. I'm about 3 hours ahead of a Drak assault fleet headed right for Earth. And Captain, they've got a shadow planet killer with them.
I see. Well, perhaps if you were to stop off here on your way, we could discuss this a little and...
Damn it, Captain, I know how this sounds, but it's true.
He's called Delenn, but her fleet is not big enough.
I've contacted Delenn, and she's calling in as many Alliance ships as she can get on this kind of short notice. But that's not enough. We need a full-scale mobilization back home.
Earth isn't going to scramble every ship they've got just because I tell them to.
Well, then you'll have to be a little more persuasive.
Why me?
Because you're still part of EarthGov. And besides, they're still a little wary of me, given what happened the last time I brought a fleet into Earth space. Captain Anderson doesn't have the clout to do it, and since he went AWOL to join us, his word's not going to count for a lot.
He's asking the impossible.
You're asking the impossible.
Then I am asking the right person. Elizabeth, if you've ever believed me, if you've ever trusted me, trust me now. You haven't seen what a death cloud can do. I have. It'll wipe out all life on Earth unless we stop it. Hell, I don't even know if we can stop it. All I do know is that we have to try.
Things are desperate and they're running out of time.
All right, I'll do what I can.
Thanks. I'll be in touch. Now get me Garibaldi.
Lockley calls Earthdome on the Gold Channel. Sheridan contacts Michael Garibaldi. He tells Garibaldi about the Drak and the Planet Killer. Garibaldi says that the Excalibur has a member of the Thieves Guild aboard who has a record as long as your arm. When Sheridan tackles Jarena and asks if this is true, she says yes. He asked her why she didn't mention it, to which she says, what's the point of being in a secret group if you tell everybody about it?
She's not wrong, point.
Yeah, that's right. Sheridan tells Garibaldi that the Drac recognize their ships, but they are prototypes and nobody has seen them before. So there must be a leak somewhere. Garibaldi realizes too late that a message sent from his ship was sent by the Mole. Surprise, surprise, it's Drake. And he has a PBG pointed at Garibaldi's head.
He seemed like such a nice man.
At this point, I did want it to cut to an alien who kind of looks like a mole. It's like, why is it always me?
Apparently, he has it in for Earth, and the Drac made him a better offer. He doesn't care what happens to Earth, as they didn't care about him. Or some such trope. The trouble is, he is surrounded on the bridge. If he shoots Garibaldi, he will be torn apart by every very unhappy Minbari around him. One of whom opens his fighting pole, which distracts Drake enough for Garibaldi to grab him by the throat and asks him to tell him what is going on, or he will hand him over to the Minbari. Drake agrees. Garibaldi calls Sheridan and says that the information they got out of Drake confirms the Drac's plans are to wipe out Earth as a show of force to the rest of the Alliance. He hopes that Lockley has convinced Earth that they need to get their forces ready. The only good news is that the Drac only have one planet killer, so if they can stop this one, they won't have to worry about another. They jump into Earth space, where the Hermes is waiting for the exercises to start. General Yuri, as he is named in the titles, because no one there could spell his full name of Yuri Mikhailovich Genisev, seems easy to me. But these are no exercises, as Drac ship after Drac ship arrives on the scene. Sheridan tells the general to leave those ships for the defense grid and to concentrate on the Death Cloud. He wants Yuri to give him a wedge of ships to punch his way through the smaller ships to get through the cloud. Although, why not wait on the other side of the jump point and attack it when it arrives? You know, you're thinking two-dimensionally. If things are arriving from in front of you, go further away from that. And when they arrive, you're behind them and you can shoot them. And
yeah. Details.
Yes. As the battle commences, Sheridan fires at the cloud with a wide dispersal of their weapons. Not to destroy it, but to see what it is made of. Some of his shots hit a superstructure, which they make out on the view screen. If they hit the right point, they can destroy it. They find it, but the target is as big as a planet. Just like David and Goliath, they need to hit the right point. Yes, okay, we know you have to hit the right point, we get it. At this point, another point, Galen's words come back to Jarena. When the time comes to choose your target, be sure to pick the right one, because you will only get one shot. As Sheridan is telling the weapons people to aim at the target, Jarena stops him and says, as a thief, you know that the family jewels are not kept in the safe, but in the armpit. In a book next to the safe. The target is not the obvious place to aim for, but there is a joint that looks like a thousand other, but has short-range weapons attached to it. That must be where the control center is located. Time is running out and things are getting desperate. Again. The Victory loses its rear weapons, so Anderson tells Sheridan.
Sheridan, standard weapons fire isn't getting through.
I know.
It's only one thing to do. You fire your main gun, it'll put you out of commission for 1 minute, but then we'll cover you until you can navigate your way out of here.
At this range, all we'll be able to do is knock out some of those ships.
Exactly. But at least you'll clear the way so that we can use our main guns, and then you can cover us. Just open up the door, Mr. President. We'll take it from there.
Sheridan agrees and fires his main weapons. Anderson orders ramming speed and flies into the control node.
As prepare for ramming speed.
This is true. Well, I don't know why you need to prepare, because once you've rammed, there's not a lot you're going to be able to do after that. What are you going to do? Hold on to your chair. Yeah. As he does so, it activates the thermonuclear missiles. Sheridan orders an evacuation of the area. The There are missiles flying in every direction, but they manage to evade them. Suddenly, all the smaller ships power down, and the defense grid destroys them all. However, two ships are spreading a brown gas-like substance into Earth's atmosphere. Jorina asks, what is it? Meanwhile, at the Major's campsite, Galen is staring into his orb again, and once again the Circle requires his presence. Back on Babylon 5, Sheridan is telling Lockley and Garibaldi about what happened at Earth.
The Romans had a phrase for it. They called it poisoning the well. They couldn't conquer, they killed. After they were driven from an area, they literally poisoned the well so no one else could live there either. It's the ultimate act of spite. If they can't have it, no one can.
So they finished analyzing whatever it was the Drock sprayed into Earth's atmosphere?
It's a biogenetic plague. Earth has been completely quarantined. No one's allowed in or out.
The plague was probably engineered by the Shadows.
The Death Cloud was the only one the Drock had left, but it wasn't the last weapon in their arsenal. From the complexity of its structure, the bioweapons division back home thinks the plague was probably engineered by the Shadows.
How much time do they have?
This looks like it's the only bright spot in this. Apparently, the Drock didn't have time to finish adjusting it to our biology, or they just didn't know how. But either way, it's going to take time for the plague to adjust to a new host. Now, they're saying 5 years. Could be less. And some people will be affected by it sooner than others. But probably 5 years is the best guess for now.
And at the end of 5 years?
Every man, woman, and child of Earth will be dead. Unless they can find a cure.
John, if the plague was created by shadow technology centuries ahead of our own, how do they plan to solve it in 5 years?
They can't.
Maybe they can find a cure out there.
But since this came to us from outside, then maybe we can find a cure out there. I mean, we know that there are other races as old as the Shadows. One of them must have found a cure. We'll find them. We have to.
Sheridan has ordered the Excalibur to be manned by the best crew they can find, who will then travel every corner of space looking for a cure. The Excalibur is the only one of its kind, and those who command it will never stop, never give up, never surrender. Oh, sorry. Until they find the cure.
And we'll take any help we can get, wherever and whoever it comes from. Because this is a cause that surpasses borders and differences and distrust. This is a mission about the survival of Earth itself. What we do over the next 5 years, here, at home, and across the darkness between the stars, will determine whether an entire world will live or die. It's a fight we can't afford to lose. And we won't. We won't.
And you know what else they won't stop searching for? This promo for another podcast right here on the ESO Network.
Search no longer, because it's right here.
Helm, report.
Sir, there's Klingons on the starboard bow.
Starboard bow?
Starboard bow!
What are they doing there?
They seem to be waiting for the new episode of Earth Station Trek.
Science, what do we know about this Earth Station Trek?
It's a podcast that treks through the history of Star Trek, from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
Navigation, how would one find such a podcast?
By setting coordinates for earthstationtrek.com or by doing a sensor sweep of Spotify, iTunes, or any other quadrant where fine podcasts are available.
Captain, what are we going to do about the Klingons?
We come in peace, Commander. Weapon station, shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill!
Shoot to kill!
Okay, before we get into the trivia, I would like to just say something. Yesterday, we were recording this on the 3rd of April. Yesterday was the 2nd of April, and exactly 10 years ago, I lost a friend of mine who could have been a friend of my two colleagues here. His name was Brian Baker, and he was on the what was the name of
the one with Lou, right?
Yes, the Lou Trek show. He was on the Lou Trek show with Lou
Costanza.
I was going to say the same thing. Lou Costanza, yes. And it was that was the show that I first ever recorded a podcast on. They invited me on to talk about the Five Doctors of Star Trek. And I had the unenviable task of staying awake till 2 o'clock in the morning to speak to them because of the time differences and that the day we were recording it. And that really started my podcasting career. So it also means that I've been podcasting for about 10 years, I suppose. That would have been 2014. So it would have been 12 years ago that I started podcasting. So Brian was a great guy. He was a brilliant guy. He had a great sense of humor, and he had exactly my sense of humor as well. And just as we were getting to know each other, he sadly passed away. He suffered a brain tumor. Hopefully, he passed very quickly, but as brain tumors do tend to have that effect on people. It's the only time I have really sort of thought that I had so much in common with this person. We'd spoken a few times. We'd started becoming pen pals, back in the day of obviously emails, and we invited him on to 10 Forward to become a cast member of 10 Forward. Unfortunately, he didn't reply because he couldn't, and I think it was one of the biggest losses. We'd still be recording now with 10 Forward if Brian had come on board. He was that sort of guy. He appeared on a couple of dramedies that I created, the Pathfinder series. He did some voices for that. He did the absolute amazing impressions of various characters, including I can't think of the guy's name. Andrew Robinson's character.
Garrick,
thank you. Straight out of my head. It's because I'm not talking with the script. He did an amazing impression of him. And I just wanted to use him more and more on those shows. But when he passed away, sadly, it didn't feel as though I could carry on with that. So we stopped it. So 10 years to the day. And I still have that recording of an episode where we both sort of said something and we both knew that we were, this friendship was going to start from here and get bigger and bigger. I've still got that recording somewhere. It's one of the very few times that I can point and say, I'm going to be a friend with this guy. And that's the moment. It's happened actually with you two guys as well. And another couple of friends that I've made locally. Just one of those special moments when you meet somebody, you think this is going to be a great relationship. And sadly it was taken away from us far too early. He was only 42. So that's I think we should dedicate this episode to him and his memory, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, moving on to the trivia. According to Babylon 5 canon, the original Drak plan had been to use the Death Cloud on Earth and then use the plague on Minbar. However, when the Death Cloud was destroyed, the plague was the only significant weapon they had left. In the original storyline, there was a subplot in which Drake plans to marry the love of his life, which is thwarted when someone else proposes to the woman first.
Oops.
I'm glad that wasn't in there.
I think we missed a significant, great addition to the story by not having that.
It could have made the whole thing, you could have liked him more, couldn't you then? I think.
Yeah, the Weasley absolutely. Guy got thwarted in his marriage, you know?
Yeah. During the evacuation from the planet killer, a warlock destroyer can be briefly seen. I wouldn't even know what one looks like.
Nope.
Okay. One with a big pointy hat on, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Had a mouth at the bottom going, door.
There's a big white beard hanging off the front of the ship.
The ship's badge of the EAS Charon is clearly seen in the background of a few scenes, which displays a K, its model series letter. In addition, an identical K upper left arm patch can be seen on several crew members' uniforms, but when the Charon is seen crossing the screen in one scene, her model series letter merely displays a C on the forward hull. Yes, because Charon is spelt with a C, and it is, I believe, one of the moons of Pluto, off the top of my head.
It's a moon of some kind.
Charon, not Charon. If you're pronouncing it Charon, you got it wrong. Or you're American. When Jurina hits the Thieves Guild member, he falls backwards over a section of pipe. You can see it bend when he first hits it, revealing it to be a rubber prop painted to look like metal. Oh, this I did not...
It's what all those Jarzy balconies are made out of.
Yes, it's the same material. Rubinium.
Rubinium. Love it.
Andrei Hulez is Hungarian and speaks English, Hungarian, Slovenian, and French. In other appearances, he also uses German, Russian, Croatian, Arabic, Chechen, and Lakota Sioux, as well as a number of accents. And this is the guy who played Yuri, the Russian, which I thought was hilarious, because when he first started talking, I thought, that's the worst Russian accent I've ever heard. What on earth is he saying? He's slurring his words and all sorts of things, only to find out he's Hungarian. I can speak Russian.
And he went to the Pavel Chekhov School of Linguistics.
Quite probably, yes. However,
we do not recognize your whistle.
Yes, it was almost like that. I have seen him in Apollo 13, where he plays one of the technicians who helps the astronauts get into their suits. His name is Gunter Vent. And I remember the Gunter Vent because Tom Hanks' character says, "Ah, Gunter Vent. I wonder where Gunter Vent." Okay, quickly, Sean, are there any Star Trek connections?
Boy, are there. Yes, definitely. Okay, let's start from the bottom here. We've got Margene Holder, who played the Earth Force Navigator. She was in Deep Space Nine in the episode Empok Nor as a character named Slotskov.
Okay.
Or Slotzov, whatever. And then we've got David Coburn, who played a Minbari Ranger. He was in The Next Generation as Ensign Brower in the episode The Nth Degree. We've got Michael Harris, who played Bishop. He was in The Next Generation episode Liaisons as Ambassador Byleth. We've got Scott McDonald, who played the First Officer. He was in The Next Generation episode Face of the Enemy as Sub-Commander Nevek. He was in two episodes of Deep Space Nine, where he played Tosk and Goran Agar. But Tosk, you remember Tosk?
Yeah.
I am Tosk. In Voyager, he played Rollins in The Caretaker. And in Enterprise, he played Commander Dolum in 8 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah. But the star of the show, of course, is Tony Todd, who played Leonard Anderson. He was in The Next Generation 3 episodes as Worf's brother Kern. In Deep Space Nine, he was Kern and the older Jake Sisko in The Visitor. In Star Trek Voyager, he was the Alpha Hirogen in Prey, and he was also the voice of several characters in video games, such as Star Trek Elite Force, Star Trek Online, and Star Trek The Next Generation Klingon Honor Guard.
Very good. What a guy.
Indeed.
So let's move on to our ratings. We rate these films out of 5 for because it's Babylon 5 and it's 5 jump gates. IMDb rate theirs out of 10, and they have given this film a 7.1, which equates to
3.55.
Quite possibly.
I'm guessing.
Maths was never my strong point, which is why I have spreadsheets.
Yes, indeed.
Dan, what would you give this episode?
Oh, we're skipping.
Oh, sorry, but I said Dan.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Dan can go. I don't have to be first all the time.
That's all right. It's all now. It's a new frontier now that we've got into a crusade territory. That's it. Okay, I'll go first. It's a good, solid TV movie in that it has the characters we recognize. It had elements of what worked in Babylon 5. And they carried it through into this hour and a half of entertainment. We had the familiar enemies in the Drax, so we're not starting a whole brand new one like we did with the Rangers, with the Hand, who may or may not be in the Drax, but just by a different name. it was something that, you know, it felt familiar. It felt like we'd been leading to this. The talk of building a dreadnought version of the White Stars was already in season 5. So now we get to see it. There's consequences from what happens in season 5. So there's the reward to someone, the fan who's been watching the show. The only problem, like I said at the very beginning, is it feels like it's too much of a setup for a new series. It can't just be a TV movie in its own right, which kind of lets it down for me. And there's the bit with the ropey jokes, the very unusual Galen, who, again, like I say, I could not get Richard O'Brien out of my mind. Just but his voice, the way he delivered every line, it felt like he was going to break into song and this was going to be a musical movie. Garibaldi was on top form as well, talking down, you know, with the gun to him, you know, if you're going to have to do it, you're going to shoot me in the face, but then you've got to deal with everybody else on the bridge. He was being the Garibaldi that I remember from season 3 and 4. So it was fun. It was nice to have all these characters. And yeah, we got to see Babylon 5 again as well. Admittedly, maybe I would have liked Chakar. I just liked Chakar and everything. But I really enjoyed this. It was nice to see Tony Todd as well. I probably would have liked him to be the captain going forward into Crusade, but I know we weren't going to get that as soon as he had his little video conference with his daughter. As soon as that happened, it was like, oh, okay, he's too expensive. They can't keep him. He can't be the regular captain. So it's not a perfect score. I can't give it a complete 4 either. So I'm just going to dip it just down to 3.9.
Ooh, okay. Okay, then. Sean.
You know what? I liked it. Even though it had some pretty spotty acting, some of the effects weren't the greatest. The Galen character is just outrageous. but Tony Todd as Captain Anderson, he was great. Dorina Nafeel, she feels like a fully fleshed, formed character. John didn't feel like himself. Garibaldi did feel like himself. If we have to hear about Edgar's industry in the top 10 things on Mars, I'm going to scream if I have to hear it one more time. But this felt like Babylon 5 in a way that the last few TV movies haven't. This actually felt like part of the show, like they hadn't stopped making it. And I know that you, Dan, didn't like it because it felt like a TV movie setup. And of course it was, but that's what I like, because it feels like it's going to flow right into the next thing.
Mm.
And yeah, I just, I enjoyed it. So I give it a 4.
Ah, huh, wow. So I totally agree with both of you, and Sean, I'm the same. I like the way that this is, it's a TV movie, yes. It's set in the Babylon 5 universe, tick. It sets up something that going forward you actually want to see, because it looks like we've got a couple of good characters already. So, and you know, we got the thief. So therefore, that character could well be one of those annoying people who does things illegally to get things done, but maybe not correctly to however the captain wants it to be done or whatever. We've got this really big ship that's pretty indestructible because, you know, what the heck? It's got, you know, this plastic plating on the outside that seems to deflect all manner of weapons. Slight downside is you fire a weapon and you've got to wait a minute. Floating around in the cockpit. So, yeah, I liked the way that it sort of ran. And it was, me and Dan were talking just before we started the recording. And I said, I can't remember watching this. I must have watched it because I have the DVD box set right in front of me. But the only thing is, I would have watched it about 6 or 7 years ago. There isn't a single scene that I go, oh, I remember that bit. Or, oh, yeah, that happened. Or, you know, this character, or none of it. I can't remember a single thing.
Same, and I know I've seen it. The only part I remember is the end where they're spraying the stuff into the Earth atmosphere.
You see, I didn't even get that. I didn't even get the, oh, right, okay, so that's how Crusade starts. I can't remember much about Crusade, to be honest, because it's only the first time I've ever seen it. You know, 6 years ago, it would have been the first time I'd seen this film, because I hadn't seen anything of the TV movies. Because I watched the original series first, the first two seasons of the original series, the first three seasons of the original series, and then somehow lost it on TV because it was live TV back in those days. And you know, if you didn't watch it, if you didn't see it, if you didn't know it was on, it disappeared. So the first time I would have watched any of this is on these DVDs 6 years ago. So
But I, you know, even watching some of the episodes of season five, there were a couple I couldn't really remember, but there was always something in there somewhere, that a scene or something, or a comment or whatever. But this, just not a single thing did I recognize in this film. So it was very much as though I was coming at it first time. I didn't like the dream sequences. I didn't like the setup on the planet. It was a bit meh. That bit seemed a little bit woolly. It wasn't really connected properly. And then the second half was better because we got the mission. Now we got the people, and now we get on with things.
Yeah,
it could have been stripped down to a one episode thing, but obviously they needed a TV film, and they needed to bring in Crusade. They needed the extra characters. But it wasn't bad. It wasn't stunningly brilliant, but it was good. I liked it. Exactly the same score, Sean, just slightly above Dan. I give this a 4.
But you know what the worst part was? When we have Captain Anderson doing the video call to his wife and daughter, and he signs it off, and he's like, "I love you, Lynn," or whatever the hell her name was, but he doesn't say anything to his kid.
Yeah.
What kind of father is that?
I know. No wonder he already rammed the flipping ship into the cloud. What kind of father if I can't keep my promises? I'm the sort of father that will kill himself rather than admit he hasn't kept his promise or even said goodbye to his kid. What kind of father am I? That was not the way for that character to go. So, is that it? Are we all done?
I think that's it.
I believe so. We've called those arms.
Yeah. Arms.
Come over here.
This episode had legs. Oh, no. Arms. Anyway, that is the end of this episode. So now we're going to take a bit of a break, and we start watching Crusade, but not season one, episode one, although that's what we're going to call it. It's actually going to be episode 9, because JMS's watch order says that's the order we watch it in. So this is very much throw your DVDs up in the air, pick one out, and put it in and see what's on. Episode 9.
Can't wait.
So join us. We're going to take a little bit of a break before we do so, as we normally do in between seasons, just so we can create a little bit of a buffer, as we are recording and editing almost in the same week. So join us again in 4 weeks' time as we take a short break, when we will be discussing Crusade Season 1, Episode 1, as we're going to call it, Racing the Night. But of course, you can watch it in any order you like. You don't have to listen to it in any order that we do it in. Just pick out the ones you like.
If you have any thoughts on this episode, why not send in some feedback to the epsilon3@gmail.com. That's 3 spelled T-H-R-E-E, not the number. Or you can find us on our Facebook page. Just search for the Epsilon 3.
Well, if you have any other problems, any other questions at all, just ask.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.